now, the Mutt's destroyed.
What was that?
What my instruments read is totally unbelievable, Captain. Twice, for a split second each time, everything within range of our instruments seemed on the verge of winking out.
I want facts, not poetry.
I have given you the facts, Captain. The entire magnetic field in this solar system simply blinked. The planet below, the mass at which we're measuring, attained zero gravity.
That's impossible. What you're describing
is non-existence.
Hello, and welcome to Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I am Terry DeFellin, and I am joined, as usual, by my co-hosts, for that is who you are, Derek Mantle and Graham Sibley.
Hello.
Hello.
Good, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it's all good. So we're back with another episode, and we're continuing on with our musings on the Mirror Universe. Obviously, we're not staying with the Mirror Universe specifically. We're now moving out into other parallel universes or alternate universes or theories of parallel dimensions and all of that stuff and how they are expressed in Star Trek. And we've got a couple of episodes coming up. This is the first one, and the one after that will be on the Tholian web, and this one is going to be about the alternative factor. So please, no, don't hang up, it's all right. Please, honey. Yes, it's fair to say, gents, the alternative factor is among the least celebrated episodes of the original series. Is that fair to say?
I think you could say that. It took me three goes to actually watch this all the way through.
Oh, really? Is that bad, was it?
I kept on falling asleep.
Oh, my God. Maybe you were tired.
I was tired. Yeah. But usually I can keep going. But this was like falling asleep, and then like 20 minutes had gone past and it was still on.
Yeah. What about you, Sibley? What's your excuse?
Well, yeah, no, I did manage to stay awake all the way through. I think it's a sort of episode where you can fall asleep for 20 minutes and nothing major will have happened in it.
Yeah, it is really, really thin, isn't it, the plot?
It is extremely thin. Yes. Mm.
But there is a reason for this, isn't there?
Yes, there is a very good reason for it.
well, the reason being it's crap, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But there's a reason why it's crap. And it kind of got beset with production problems, I think it's probably fair to say, isn't it? The name of the actor who was due to play Lazarus. John Drew Barrymore. He of the Barrymores, yeah. The famous, yes. Barrymores. Well, there's different stories, two different stories that I've determined, I found. First one being that he just didn't turn up.
Yeah.
But both of them involve him not turning up, so it doesn't, yes, reflect very well, yeah, on him. But the second story was that he turned up for the first day, and then he just didn't come back from lunch or something like that.
Do you reckon he read the script?
Yeah, maybe, the story that I heard was that he turned up for a final costume fitting the day before and got the last revised script that was still wet from the printer, and he took that home with him and didn't come in the next day. But he didn't use that. He didn't say that because eventually what happened was he walked out, didn't turn up for the show at all. And the producers of Star Trek actually put in a complaint with the Screen Actors Guild.
They did, yes.
And there was a hearing, and he did manage to turn up for that one, but he didn't use it as a defence to say, actually, I didn't go attend it because the script changes were terrible and it completely changed the character.
Yeah.
And
we're talking about Lazarus, of course. Yeah. I mean, for listeners who have watched it recently or know of it, then Lazarus is the main guest star. Well, there's two Lazaruses. There's Lazari. Again, all of this is different stories according to what period of Star Trek history you are in.
Yeah.
You know, the more earlier stories about it are fairly sketchy, but later on we learn a little bit more. But we need something like 4 days from final draft to shooting. You know,
is
there
that
were
unusual?
Lots and lots of script changes, which apparently is unusual. But then we've heard stories about script changes while they're filming. So,
yeah.
But I guess these are fairly fundamental ones. There was a big subplot in which Lazarus was going to have a relationship, a romance with Lieutenant Masters.
I've read that, yeah.
Yeah.
I sort of heard, well, I've read two different descriptions of why it was cut. I don't know if you know much about that. Well, the first one I actually read was to do with the Southern states actually objecting to.
Well, the fear that they would.
Or the fear, yeah. That a black and white romance would actually cause a lot of problems. Because this is the first season, isn't it?
This is.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, the actress who plays Lieutenant Masters, stunning woman, actually. She looks
Janet McLaughlin?
Janet McLaughlin.
Yeah, and she's very unusual for a lot of appearances of, women of colour. Because obviously she has more of a naturalistic sort of hairstyle. And she stood out for me. I think she's great. I think she probably had the best of this episode, anyway.
She was a high point, definitely, in the episode.
Yeah.
And it's a shame. I remember when I first watched it, I thought, oh, new character.
Yeah.
And was still naive enough to think, oh, looking forward to seeing her again. And then without reading her, don't be daft. You're never going to see her again.
But that's the problem. Is her role is pared back so much. She's a guest star in this show. And yet she's finds her role pared back to that of basically
She's Scotty's replacement, isn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, she effectively acts as Scotty's replacement because they wanted a romance. They had a romantic subplot. They said, we need a character. Well, we'll give Jimmy the week off.
And they weren't bold enough. They weren't bold enough to let Lazarus have his romantic interest with Scotty.
No, they weren't bold enough. Yeah. And as it turns out, they then weren't bold enough to have him let him have his romantic interest with Lieutenant Masters. It worked out pretty badly.
Yeah, do you reckon the change of the relationship between Lieutenant Masters and Lazarus might have been the thing that John Barrymore objected to?
Well, we don't know. Because he never said.
Yeah,
because it seems such a big
Which is interesting, because we've never been able to get to the bottom of it. And you think after half a century, then somebody might have said. But I can only assume it's something that it's an episode he wants to put past him. He was banned for 6 months. John Drew Barrymore.
Supposedly, but I've read on some other basis that he was working within a couple of months.
Okay.
So that band didn't fully hold. No.
Okay, that's interesting. That just may well be just how the industry works. Yeah, your band is about, you know, if you do a bit of work here and there, we're going to turn the blind eye to you. Yeah. The Barrymores being quite a powerful family, I think, so maybe they just were influential.
He was quite a difficult person, apparently. He had plenty of run-ins with the constabulary.
Did he really?
Over the years.
Oh, so he might, so it
drunk,
might
drunk driving.
It might like just that. Have been a case of him just, you know, having perhaps a big headache.
Or he saw the makeup, because that weird beard.
The weird beard
that changed every day of shooting. Yeah.
If you're aware of the term beardy weirdy, then it actually stems from this episode. It's a pop culture fact, ladies and gents. Yeah, Robert Brown was called in on his birthday.
What a present!
So it was a nightmare, because what they then had to do, they had to shoot scenes that didn't involve Lazarus while they were looking for the actor. And then when it turned out that he was not coming, or they couldn't find him, they got Robert Brown, and he said, yeah, I'll do it. And then they went to his house on his birthday and dragged him out of his house.
So he opens the door
onto the set.
A present for me?
A present for me. This is a great birthday. I've got some work as well. Brilliant. Ding dong. Hello. And onto the set, off to Vasquez Rocks, they took him, I should think.
Yeah. Right, what we should do is fall off these rocks.
Again and again. Yeah. Oh, God. That's the thing. Going into the character. We're going to story now. This bloke just keeps falling over.
Take the microphone, just go, ah. A bit more emotion. Fine, that'll do. Done. Right. Okay. Right, fall off. Do you want me to go, ah? No, we've already got, you'll use your first, ah. It's fine. Don't worry. It's really bad. Yeah. So the production values on this show are very, very bad, and the story is also, because it's had this massive thing, you've got these fairly hard sci-fi concepts, I think, about the universe winking out. But
this is 1967.
No, let me rephrase that. I'm not going to cut this bit out. They're not hard sci-fi concepts. This is faux hard sci-fi.
Yeah.
The concepts behind it are just complete bobbins.
Yeah.
You know, the universe sort of winking out.
Yeah.
And this whole thing where Spock is going, well, I don't know what's going on. I mean, like, it's because, you know, it's just a badly written script, and you've got no basis whatsoever.
Don Ingalls was an old friend of Gene Roddenberry, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And there is the whole feel about it when you read about the redrafts and everything like that, that this was just, oh yeah, I'll let you do an episode on Star Trek as a favour. This was a guy who'd come from Westerns, basically. It was doing loads of Westerns at the time. And this was his first stab at science fiction. Now, a lot of the writers did cut their teeth on shows like Gunsmoke and The Virginian, and it worked well for them. But obviously for Don Ingalls, it didn't.
No, that's right.
He did work on another episode, didn't he?
Yeah, Private Little War.
Yeah.
And which was, again, it was pretty heavily rewritten by Roddenberry, and Ingalls didn't speak to Roddenberry for a year.
And he took his name off the...
Yes, so it's different. I can't remember the name, but it makes no sense.
There's a pattern there.
So, yeah, maybe this is what happened here. Maybe there were some substantial rewrites. Well, there needed to be, obviously, because of that.
Yeah.
The director is a German fellow called Geert Oswald, who was presumably a refugee because he emigrated in 1938 from Germany. And did a ton of stuff. But I think that's the only episode of Star Trek that he did, which might lend itself to its sort of slightly... Because it just doesn't feel right. It's the pacing of it is odd. But a lot of this is just because I think it's just very bad script writing. And they're trying to explain to the audience what's happening while perhaps not really fully understanding what's happening themselves.
Well, that's the thing I found. I thought that they were hopping all over the place.
Yeah.
It's like one scene you've got, like, you know... Well, it seems that there's a lot of repetition of him, like Kirk, going down to the planet and up again. Down and up again. Lazarus falling off cliffs, up and down again, and
Lazarus wandering off again. Any security?
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's like it's really funny. It's like, oh, where's Lazarus now? Oh, it's a big ship, Jim.
It's a big ship.
You know, you just let him go. You let him walk out.
Am I wearing a red shirt?
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. There's a security guard standing there.
I have dialogue. I'm wearing a blue shirt. You know, I'm not going to die. You know, I can't tell people, you know.
I mean, there's this bit on the bridge where Lazarus goes off into the turbo tube, you know, into the lift.
Yeah.
And the security guard waits for him to take the lift first, and then goes in.
And then follows him. It's like, dude, you should get into the lift with him. A lot of this you could put down to its first season, and, you know, a lot of these are tropes, Star Trek tropes that have developed over decades. And we look back on it and go, oh, you know, well, why didn't you have a security guard going around there? But first season, you can think, well, okay.
These are fudges just to keep the story going along.
Yeah.
What story there is.
Yeah, yeah. And these weird episodes where he kind of transitions, if that's the word I'm looking for, into his alternate self. And the only clue that you have is where he's got this bandage, which is on one side of his head.
Yeah.
But I swear there are times when the crazy Lazarus has got the normal Lazarus's bandage on that side, and the other way around. There's no consistency that I can see.
Yeah, a lot of the disjointedness of this episode as well, I think, is, and a lot of the unfamiliarity that you described there with the direction there, I think a lot of it has to do with when it was filmed as well, because it was filmed over Thanksgiving weekend.
Oh, right.
So, yeah. And it
too
was filmed...
Turkey.
Well, basically, everyone was on holiday. Mm. It looks like half the cast are on holiday.
Yeah.
Well, Scotty's not there. Sulu's not there.
It's
just basically the sort of... Everyone is just sort of like not there, basically.
Yeah.
And you've got Masters there, seemingly like a fill-in cast character, background cast character, rather than a guest star.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, at least it has Leslie in there.
Yeah,
Paskey
is in the big chair.
So that's quite a plus.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and the other thing is when they're summing up, sort of like they've figured out that there's two Lazaruses, and they're talking about, you know, the normal, one of them is a raving lunatic and the other one's sort of like calm and rational, and I'm thinking, hang on a second, I don't think Kirk and Spock have actually met the calm and rational one. They only ever seem to speak to the lunatic one. So how do you know that this is going on?
Yeah.
And I think that this is because that is just a remnant from an earlier draft that never got properly rewritten.
Yeah, and there's the stealing of the crystals as well. You see two of them being stolen, but two others have been stolen earlier as well.
Yeah.
That comes across in there. And you never think, hang on, did did I remember seeing that or not?
Yeah,
that happen or not?
And they probably look back on that and say, well, why? Maybe we could sort of like pass that off to the audience as suggesting that the second Lazarus, the other Lazarus, nicked them. Because I think that they were both wanting the crystals, but for both different reasons.
Yeah,
but they don't actually know.
But this is where the plot point about the romance with Masters might have actually helped, because obviously there would have been a case of the two different Lazaruses with her.
Yeah,
sort of the conflict of the different personalities, which would have called, you know, and I presume that they probably would have used him to actually get the crystals through her at some point. And
that was the whole thing.
You know, it would have made more sense
One of the reasons why, given for writing the relationship out, was because, and this is, I think, what Roddenberry said, was that they didn't want to have another episode where a female member of the crew fell in love with a dashing protagonist.
Oh, right. And Space Seed thing.
And yeah, it was exactly that, because it was very close to Space Seed in the production order.
Mm.
And I think they said, well, you know, we've already got this going on here.
Mm.
Do we really want this going on? Yeah. And especially as well with the fact that, also, I think compounded by the fact that they'd cast Janet McLachlan in there, which was great casting. But I think there was the opportunity there for them to say, actually, okay, we've already contracted her now. We've already paid her $750.
Yeah.
Okay, why don't we put her off for another episode? We'll use her in another episode that we can get in there. We'll get someone else in that will fit nicer, like more comfortably in the southern states. But they didn't. They went with it. They went with her as a guest star when they're in this horribly cut down role. I mean, like, it's great that she's there and all that screen time, but she's really just may as well just be saying Hailing Frequencies Open.
Yeah.
For the amount of input she has in this episode.
Yeah. Well, there was supposed to be another guest star in there who was the jealous
boyfriend,
quote unquote boyfriend.
Oh, right.
To Masters.
Yeah.
But that obviously got cut out as well.
Because that's actually one of the nicer scenes, actually, that below decks bit when they're in the room.
That element of it. I mean, we've talked about this before in early episodes of TOS, is the lower decks element to it that we've seen. And unfortunately, you know, lamentably, in my opinion, that was never really continued on throughout the rest of the series. Mm-hmm. It became more and more focused on Kirk, Spock and McCoy. But this would have presumably been another example of that. And, I mean, it didn't happen. And it does explain. I mean, it would have been a much more watchable episode, I think, if that had been
able to keep that in. It feels like the guts have been cut out.
It does. Yeah.
The whole thing about the racial element of the episode, I find quite fascinating. If you look at the timeline around there, because obviously you've got, you compare this to the famous interracial kiss that there is in Star Trek in Plato's Stepchildren, and you think, well, what's the difference in the timeline here when we've got this that is made end of 1966 and Plato's Stepchildren that comes out around the end of 1968? There's only 2 years in between time.
A lot of things happened.
But a lot of stuff happened.
Yeah.
Primarily, as far as the entertainment world is concerned, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner comes out end of 1967, which pretty much changes everything what you are ready for on screen and whatnot. I mean, it's a real genre defining or mold breaking film and a turning point for Hollywood. Or it should have been, but obviously it took a long time for it to really get into effect. Also, as well, 1968, you have the assassination of Martin Luther King, another pivotal moment in American history. So I think those things there, the seeds of those, and obviously these have to play on the producers of television shows, and it takes that long. And even when it does come along, it's a forced kiss.
Yes, it's deliberately
so there is nothing romantic about what actually happens there, is there? So it's still a long way to go, and it's very difficult to sort of put ourselves into 1966 and say, oh, God, they should have just got ahead with it. They should have been brave and for what is basically an hour of television.
But it would have shared if they had gone ahead with it, it would have shared the distinction of being an interracial kiss in a rubbish episode of Star Trek, because Plato's Stepchildren is among the...
Well, it might have been a good episode if they kept a lot of that stuff in.
Appreciate your optimism, I really do, and I think that there's so much else going wrong with this episode. I mean, there are scenes like that big, there's a long scene between Kirk and Spock in the briefing room where they're sort of like laying out what they think is going on. That scene is too long. And it's clear that they've got, you know, they've got pages and pages of script. They've got minutes to fill, and they're like, we don't have any story. Yeah. We've got no plot. What do we do? So let's just stretch this scene out as much as we possibly can.
It's terrible dialogue.
Yes.
Well, it does suggest, is this episode bad because it's just a bad story idea, or is it bad because they've stretched it out so much that you have to, that you've got nothing to distract you from it? All you've got is this weak story, I think Dale's got a point
that if that subplot had been put in there, that would have accounted for a hefty chunk of the episode, and it would have distracted us from the otherwise flimsiness.
Yeah.
We've seen plenty of ropey plots in Star Trek, haven't we? Ropey premises, and still perfectly watchable, and in fact, in times, classic episodes.
But they're often saved by the comic elements or romantic elements from the subplots, and the conflict that brings into what is a basic story of issue resolution.
Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely, and this is clearly what has happened here. But I think it does emphasise also the importance of characters in Star Trek.
Yeah,
and that it is characters that tend to make Star Trek. So you know, I mean, it's a huge, and if you don't have likable characters or any characters, then you've got a problem.
Which for me is where this episode really falls down, because the characters just aren't there. The regular characters just don't buy into it at all. They're either not there or they're not there.
McCoy just seems to be, you know, again, really carelessly written. And Spock is like, well, I don't really know what's happening. And then all the way down to, I mean, even Lazarus, I mean, Robert Brown obviously deserves a great deal of credit for trying to stitch this together. But even they have this whole business when he's on this holy cause to defeat his nemesis, the Beast. And the portrayal of the Beast, who, you know, as we discover, is in fact his alter ego from a mirror universe, which is the reason why we're talking about this, or a parallel universe, which is the reason why we're talking about this episode to begin with. But none of these are developed. I mean, like, you know, is Mad Lazarus truly mad? Is he mentally ill? Why is he calling it a holy cause? And these are kind of taken to a certain point, and then they're just dropped.
Well, the name Lazarus, anyway, is the religious aspect to that. First, that's what I thought.
Right.
Because Lazarus was brought back by Jesus when he...
Yes. Of course. Because it's a miracle. The writers have clearly thought, we've got something here.
And it feels like that, because he basically says... He does use the word holy war, doesn't he? I suppose he is meant to come across as a zealot, isn't he? As someone who has been, who is on a mad cause, or is driven, or is...
Well, it's a cause of revenge, because he says at the beginning that he's fighting against the anti-life, the beast, anti-life that had destroyed his civilization. That's where you think it's really big. There's some really good ideas there. Mm. Creature intelligence has destroyed his planet and his civilization, and so that's what I got at the beginning.
Mm.
And that's actually dispensed with later on, you know, because we find out again there's another twist which doesn't make any sense, because you find that spaceship where he's on the planet,
the George Jetson car,
which is just
I mean, obviously Matt Jeffries was away that week as well, because that is I tried to find out, you know, through the usual sources, you know, the genesis of that vehicle. I daren't call it a ship.
I think that the funfair had been travelling through that day, and then one of those things fell off the lorry.
It does look,
you know,
yes.
It's sort of...
It's off one of the arms of the Merry Mixer, isn't it?
Yeah. Either that, or it was the ill-fated live-action George Jetson's movie, as you say, that never got off the ground, but they thought, oh, we'll have that. Yoink.
Yoink.
Yeah. I mean, that takes us to the sort of meat of the story, I suppose, the existence of the parallel universe, one being antimatter and one being matter, and then obviously with the two, if the two meet, then
Yeah.
And then you have this corridor, which appears to be this
the blue corridor.
Empty blue room.
The blue room with explosives each side, which is a prison. It's a prison at one time, you know. It changes all over the place.
It's just such a hokey construct.
And then actually we find out that Jetson's car is not a spaceship. It's actually a time machine.
Yeah.
It's
a transporter.
It's
isn't
a rubbish time machine.
Yeah, it's a rubbish time machine.
That's what it is.
You know,
And we find out as well that the other universe isn't actually hasn't got a proper outside. It's actually a studio.
When he goes over
there, he actually turns into a Soundstage 10 at the Desilu Studio.
Yes. Yeah. It's not very well thought through. I mean, and the transition effects as well are really cheesy, and the double exposure is just really
and overused.
Dated.
And then there's the sort of like the Batman
swiveling
newspaper.
Kind of like
I always thought that was a newspaper.
Every time I think I was expected to see come some kind of headline. I thought I was transported into Citizen Kane for about half a second, and then realised, oh no, I'm watching a very bad TV episode.
Yeah.
I mean, have you got any thoughts about remastered versus original here, or is it just too nasty to just think?
No, because I haven't seen the comparison for it.
I didn't. I watched.
Funny enough, I saw some bits on the interweb.
Yeah.
Where they actually compared some frames. I mean, obviously the usual thing was with the ship.
Yeah.
And the planet. They did change the planet, which we know. But they did do something with the. The purple and blue room, they'd actually cleaned up the special effects with that. Even, I mean, it looks very wonky anyway. Mm. I mean, you know, the one that I watched was pretty wonky, and that was the remastered one.
Mm.
You know, but they cleaned it up. The only other thing which is really interesting is that, and it was a bit that got me as well, when they have to destroy the spaceship time machine.
Mm.
You know, when they're on the planet, why didn't they just blow it up? Or something.
Yeah, why didn't they just like why did it have to be done from space?
So they all go up and then, you know, up onto the bridge and sort of like ready to sort of. But there's a lovely shot there where you see the Enterprise at a different position. You actually see the back of the Enterprise looking down. And
they did
remaster that as well. So the two shots were different, you know, from the usual episode of Star Trek.
Okay.
So yeah, you see the rear of the. So you see the nacelles. And then a slightly different angle and the planet in the foreground.
Okay, so that's quite nice.
Yeah, that's
an unusual thing. We always like to see new beauty shots of the Enterprise, don't we? It's quite rare.
But the old shot was actually interesting as well. I mean, because they hadn't done that before either.
No, so it's odd that they didn't reuse that as well.
Mm. Yeah.
Because they did obviously reuse a heck of a lot of these shots.
Yeah.
So it's odd that maybe they just felt this. Let's just forget this episode and never speak of it again, and not use anything from it ever again. The final-ish sequence, where it's all finally explained to the befuddled viewer. Where we actually really for the first time meet sort of like not mad Lazarus from the other universe. I quite enjoy that scene.
Mm-hmm.
I know we're coming to the end of the episode and then this is going to be over soon. But I also think that we get to, having put up with raving Lazarus all the way through, to have nice, measured, calm, friendly Lazarus is actually, you know, quite nice.
Force him through his threshold while I'm waiting for him into the corridor. And I'll hold him there.
You can't hold him forever.
Can't I, Captain? You destroy his ship.
But if I destroy his ship, won't yours also be destroyed?
It will.
And your door will be closed.
Yes, and so will his.
You'll be trapped inside that corridor with him forever. At each other's throats throughout time.
Is it such a large price to pay for the safety of two universes?
And, you know, I mean, and again, I think it's, you know, massive props to Robert Holmes for doing this under trying circumstances. And he said apparently it was an incredibly tense set. So going back to what you were saying, Graham, that, you know, clearly no one had bought into this, thought it was going to be a stinker right from the off, and then it was. And I quite enjoyed that aspect to it, but again, within minutes, it was just, you know, even the bit where he has to put Lazarus through the threshold of his hokey, crappy time machine. And the wrestling is just like, and all you've got Spock and these security guards just standing there looking at him. And you're like, stay back, so why? You don't have to stay back, help him. Just like, Spock, help me get this twat through this thing so that we can end this shitty episode and go back to our lives. And but no, he says, no, I'll do this. It's
It was funny, like, stay back. And all the security guards are looking really bored. What did he say?
Why did we bother coming down here?
You asked us to come down here, and then you told us you want to do it all, don't you? That's your trouble, Jim.
Yeah.
You want to do it all.
Yeah.
You're one of those COOs who has to be involved in everything. Yeah. You can't just let other people do their job. You can't stand on their own. And say, oi, grab him and chuck him in there. Do your job, all right? No.
Well, can we find any positives from this?
Well, I like the principle at the ending. I think the idea of being trapped for all eternity with, you know, with the madman at your throat, I thought that you know, when Kirk was trying to sum up, you know, the purgatory that good Lazarus had put himself into.
The dialogue, though.
No, the dialogue is all terrible. But
there's some pathos there.
There's nobility in the act. But I mean, I think that's one redeeming character. I think obviously Janet McLaughlin, we can only wonder what might have been.
Yeah.
And applaud the fact that they had a woman of colour in a prominent role.
Some nice new sets as well.
We got some nice sets.
Yeah.
That's
about it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, think there's much more I still have to bring up about that dialogue, though. What of Lazarus?
What of Lazarus?
What of Lazarus?
What of Lazarus?
It was getting Can we just
Lazarus,
move on?
You know, they're going, no, sorry.
And it also finishes on, like, you know, a normal episode usually has an upbeat sort of thing. And they tried to do this sort of downbeat because, you know, the pathos that this person sacrificed himself for all eternity.
Mm. Yeah, at least we were spared exactly.
That was more a second season thing.
Yeah. We still had some downbeat endings. We did have some downbeat endings. The Charlie X is a big, it's quite a downbeat ending. Yeah, with this idea of, things ending badly for everybody. You know, including everybody, you know, but either side of the camera, frankly.
I don't know, but you two guys will probably know better than I will. Has anyone done a sequel to this episode?
That's a good question.
Because usually around this time, we're usually talking about things like Star Trek Continues or comic books or something that has picked on an idea and then run with it again.
I forgot to actually check Memory Alpha to see if there was any spin-offs, because usually the Memory Alpha are actually...
I have not come across anything.
No, me neither.
And I'm glad.
Yeah, I mean, when I watched it again for this, I thought, did something, there's a kernel of interest here. And then the more I watched, I thought, oh no, actually, this is rubbish.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I can't see any kind of, I mean, they totally save the universe in this episode. I mean, like, it's a cosmic episode of Star Trek, because they totally save everybody. Everyone living, they totally save them. You'd think that they'd get a medal for something like that.
Yeah.
But it's there's no, I can't think of any revisiting.
I suppose that what they do is why we're discussing it, isn't it? It's because it goes on to become the mirror universe, doesn't it?
Yeah.
They completely rethink the idea, and they actually, we can use this idea.
Yeah.
And we can do it completely.
Yeah, it could be, I suppose, yeah. I mean, do you think they were thinking of that when they were thinking up Mirror Mirror?
I don't, because, you see, this was supposed to be... there's a kernel in the idea about the antimatter and positive matter.
Hmm.
And the idea that I thought that the two characters, if they meet, will basically set off a chain reaction that would obliterate everything. So it was like they were using a bit of scientific theory that was just out there, hadn't actually been properly worked on by the guys, you know, with antimatter and matter. There was like those theories, stuff like this. So the guy who actually wrote this, obviously he took some, read a couple of scientific journals. Yes. This is a really good idea.
Ooh, that sounds fun.
Yes. We'll throw in this blue room type thing, this prison with explosives either side of the doors, all that sort of stuff, and, you know, and then we'll just throw it out to the kids and they'll love it. But there was the scientific idea about antimatter and positive matter meeting and then obliterating the universe. And I thought that because it's such a big idea that there's, you know, you could destroy two universes. The rest of Starfleet decide to leave the Enterprise as bait for this invasion, and then just.
Oh, I forgot that they all thought that maybe yes, it could only be a prelude to invasion. I said, oh, really? I don't think it can. This is not arena.
Well, that's something that you didn't see as well. Him talking face to face with Starfleet.
No,
that was a new thing.
Yeah, and
we don't see that again until TNG, do we?
That's true. Yeah, that's true. So yeah, it's a bit. Yeah, it's pretty slim pickings.
Yeah,
and good
sure.
on you for bringing it up.
I'm sure.
Good
it
on
is.
You for bringing it up.
But you know, we've been walking around this pile up to our knees in this episode.
Yeah,
and,
we have.
And if we can find anything sparkly in here, then...
and I think we
pulled a lot of stuff out of it.
Yeah, we pulled some stuff out.
It needs a good wash and a bit of disinfecting.
Yeah. I mean, well, what we could also say about it is that it wasn't offensive.
No.
Well, I suppose this is
or
the thing,
was
isn't it? Yeah, because this is the... And well, no, it got rid of all the offensive stuff that they could have had in there, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I think we can look at that. We can look at bad episodes. And there are bad episodes of Star Trek, and we've talked about them on here.
Mm.
But they're generally bad because they haven't aged very well at all.
Mm.
And some were pretty offensive even at the time.
Mm.
So if we're looking at episodes like Turnabout Intruder, Wolf in the Fold, Paradise Syndrome, those are episodes that are just that are unsettling because you just don't like watching them because they come across as either
misogynistic, racist. Yeah. Yeah.
And then you've got other episodes that are just a bit weird and a bit annoying. Things like, you know, And the Children Shall Lead, Plato's Stepchildren,
Spock's Brain,
yeah, and things like that.
Yeah.
That are just a bit weird, and The Way to Eden, I suppose. A lot of people don't like that because it's, you know, it's got hippies in it.
Although, as we know, we've blown that one
We've
apart.
Blown that one
That's
apart.
That's actually
yeah.
a good episode.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to seeing other ones of these bad episodes.
Yes, yeah, so cool pick, bad episodes,
yeah. If we can reimagine them.
And we were hoping that maybe the alternative factor might be one of those, might be another Way to Eden. We've unearthed the gem, lads.
Yeah, no, there
and
is,
we haven't.
We have not. No, no.
It's just a can of Coke from the 1970s.
Yeah, or it's
metaphorically speaking.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's not. It's not even a coprolite. It is. Yeah.
And you're right. There's no charm to it. So all of the episodes, the rubbish episodes that you spoke, and the Children's Release, Spock's Brain.
Yeah.
You know these episodes. There's something about them that we can pin on and say, oh, ha ha. You know, there's a whiff of Plan 9 from Outer Space about it,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes,
so
yeah.
These are Ed Wood episodes. They're not offensive.
No.
They're just a bit rubbish.
Yeah, or a bit annoying.
Yeah. Alternative Factor is just naff. It's just a naff episode.
It's just really, really, really just poorly put together.
Yeah.
Yeah, we like to celebrate Star Trek, but obviously you can't really celebrate this episode.
No.
Ignore it. It didn't have a rerun. On network TV, it had to wait till syndication.
It was that bad.
So
yeah,
they obviously knew it was a stinker, and sort of thought, let's just get rid of it.
But there were like 28, 29 episodes in that first season.
Yeah.
And most of them are pretty damn solid.
Yeah.
So this one is
especially
the
stinker. Especially around that part of the run as well.
Yeah.
You sort of think, well, this is when the gold is coming out.
And then there's this.
They hide this one in the middle of it.
Yeah.
As you said, it's a troubled... I mean,
yes, it's a trouble production.
Yeah.
And so we can pin that on that. All right. Well, I don't have anything more to say about the alternative factor. Do you?
No.
No?
No.
No. All right, then.
I could get my evil twin from the alternative universe to come in here. He'd probably love it.
But is he evil, though, Graham? Yeah. Is he evil? And maybe you are the one who's evil.
Maybe you are the evil, or you're the mad one. Yes. And he's actually
join my crusade, brothers. Come on. If he comes in here, he will go.
What of Sibley, Derek? What of Sibley?